Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about golems, the original robots of D&D. Are they too powerful or not enough? Do they fit the theme properly? Should you change them in your game? All about golems today.
robots of golems. D&D. Yeah, right? I didn't hear it put that way. That's great. You know, I was thinking about that, about sort of what aspect golems fit into in D&D. Why is it even important? Why are they even there? And I was trying to think of how I use them. And I was thinking about how, like yeah, there's kind of this classic trope of exploring dungeons, usually like ancient tombs, like, old pyramids or burial places or whatnot. You get into this problem of like, well, what kind of monsters can I put in there? Either they're new inhabitants, right? Things like goblins or kobolds have snuck into this place and live here now, you know, or they're old remnants and they're things like, you know, the undead. And golems fit this interesting niche of sort of like, well, they're an intentionally placed guardian, right? A thing that doesn't, that sits stagnant until needed. At least that's yes. How I've seen them. Use. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting trap. They're like a trap. They're a hybrid monster slash trap.
Correct. I think that like the fifth edition book specifically like highlights their agelessness. So they can stand in one place for an arbitrary amount of time. I'm going to apologize a little bit to our YouTube viewers. I guess we didn't direct to the advance event properly. So hopefully if people find us on our live. But we are live on YouTube currently, so hopefully people find that WanderingDM/live URL. We'll get you there currently.
Yeah.
So spread the word.
I'm sure. Yeah, I was gonna say they can't hear you saying that, Dan. So sorry, everyone.
So let's talk about the historical folklore for golems a little bit. Obviously, they weren't entirely invented just for D&D. I found kind of, originally they do come from Jewish folklore. And I saw this great quote that someone wrote in Moment magazine, again, talking about the folklore of golems originally. They said, the golem is a highly mutable metaphor with seemingly limitless symbolism. It can be a victim or a villain, a Jew or a non-Jew, a man or a woman or both. Over the centuries, it has been used to connote war, community, isolation, hope, and despair. If you think all the things that you could use with golems in your D&D game, that's a very meaty vein to dig into.
Fascinating. That's a lot.
Yeah,
it seems like a lot for the robots in D&D.
It kind of is. So I actually really like, right, and so over the years or centuries, there's a whole lot of different iterations of the golem story. But to my limited understanding of Jewish folklore, there are a number of stories of rabbis with particularly powerful supernatural connection that allows them to halfway create a living being that's very powerful, that's in their service. And possibly the best known one is the story about a 16th century rabbi in Prague, which is now the capital of the Czech Republic, who created a golem to defend the Jewish community there from a tyrannical Roman emperor of the time. And the golem is of course, powerful. It's totally mindless. It's formed from crude clay, protects the community for a while, and then at some point goes berserk. And the rabbi loses control, and the golem goes on a murderous rampage and needs to be deactivated. And at least in one version of the story, I love this little detail. I love the little detail that to activate the golem, so form it out of clay, and to activate the golem, you've got to inscribe on the head the word Emet, which is the Jewish word for truth, which is actually three letters in Hebrew, mm-hmm. to my understanding, truth. And then to deactivate it, if you can get on it and erase the first letter, then the word becomes Met, which is the word for death. And then the golem is no longer active. Right. I love that. I have a couple of miniatures, for my D&D games, and specifically my clay golem, I guess I'm not going to get that well on camera, but if you look really, I attempted to get the Hebrew lettering right on the head. It's very blurry there, but.
Yeah.
So I tried to get the right three characters there on the head as a little detail, and if you see a clay golem pop up in my D&D game, that'll be on the table.
Kind of put up this image here. That's looks like we can see the letters. Yeah.
Exactly. And for what it's worth, Hebrew is written right to left, so the first letter is actually the aleph on the far right. As a matter of fact. So you see that this is like a really early version of these themes of a mindless, you know, dangerously literal servant. And so that echoes through the years in stories like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or, mm-hmm. you know, robots or artificial intelligence. Very similar to de Camp's Fallible Fiend, right? Very similar, like overly literal, doing exactly what you say, and as a result being very dangerous. That feeds into D&D about, you know, summon servants or the wish spell or things like that. Interestingly, little detail that I just caught on to last night. The word robot's only been around for about 100 years. We're just a couple months past the 100th anniversary of Carol Chapek creating the word robot in his play R.U.R., which was published in 1921. And interestingly, Chapek wrote that book in Prague, which is where the story about the golem is from. So when I said at the top that golems are the robots of D&D, there's actually a very clear real-world connection between the Prague golem story and Chapek creating the story about robots for the first time in the same city just 100 years ago.
Fascinating. So, in original D&D, Dan, are there multiple types of golem, or is it just the clay variant?
Great question, and it's exactly the opposite of what you expect. So, the D&D clay golem is the best representation of the folklore golem, and that's the one that wasn't there to begin with. So, if you pull up, I think, like the first piece of text that I've got for an image there. So in the Little Brown Books, it came from the very first box in 1974, in the monster book, you get the monster list, and at the end, there's a couple snippets of like other things you could add to your game, and this is all you get about golems, is there's a section that says robots, golems, androids, is what we're looking at right now, and it says self-explanatory monsters, which are totally subjective as far as their characteristics are concerned. That's all you get. So just robots, golems, and androids are clearly all the same thing, and they're self-explanatory, Paul. What more do you really need?
Nothing, obviously. I was foolish to even look it up. Should just put them in the game. It's fine.
Now, interesting, there's other paragraph there about living statues, which starts talking about various stone and metal monsters which come to life if trespass into a certain area is made. And then there's a detail about one of these monsters, and maybe we'll come back to that later is what I'm thinking.
Okay.
So in the original publication, we didn't have any details. First supplement, go forward about 6 months or to the next image. And Gary Gygax published his Greyhawk supplement, things that you've seen in his Greyhawk campaign in 1975. And here you actually get details for the first time. And you can see on this table here, there's three types as originally published. There's the flesh golem, the stone golem, and the iron golem. There is no clay golem like the original folklore story. That first appeared in Strategic Review number four in winter 1975. They added the clay golem as the fourth. Initially, it wasn't there. So, you know, in general strokes, the flesh golem is kind of like the Frankenstein monster. So it's stitched together of, old flesh powered by lightning specifically. and is the weakest of the bunch. The stone golem is similar to my mind of like something out of a Harryhausen movie. And then the iron golem, which is the most powerful type, is a pretty clear nod to Talon, the Greek myth of a giant construct made by Hephaestus, which appears in the Argonaut story. And the clay golem, which is really most like folklore, didn't come until another year after that.
So I'm looking at my BX books here to try and remember, because I think my brain is telling me it's going to be different and weird in BX. And sure enough, BX, I'm seeing that there is, well, of course, obviously wood, bone, amber, and bronze. Those are our choices.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that doesn't appear, I mean, at least at the time, in the AD&D line versus the basic line, basic doesn't have flesh, stone, iron, and AD&D doesn't have these weaker types that Moldvay and Cook made up for inclusion. So
why on earth did they need to make up a whole separate set of golems for basic?
These are too powerful, right? The original D&D golems are way too powerful for either the basic or the expert game. And to kind of reveal something I was going to say at the end.
Really? I mean,
of
expert is getting you up to 14th level, right?
Not enough. Not enough, sir.
Really? Okay. All right. All right.
Not nearly enough. Not even remotely enough, as a matter of fact. So these golems, I think if they're interpreted the way they're literally written on the page here in the original D&D supplement, they are... So when I run my statistical analyses of these, like the Iron Golem literally breaks my whole system. The Iron Golem is a sufficiently big outlier that I had to do a whole lot of extra coding just to handle it alone. And the stone and the iron golem in my calculating are the two of the top three most dangerous monsters in the game.
Well, all right then.
Yep.
Who worse saw than that a lich, coming?
Worse I thought than it, a Titan. I, yep.
Worse than a dragon? I mean, it's Dungeons and Dragons.
Yep. Worse than any dragon. Golems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, now it's jailers and golems.
Jailers and golems.
Someone help me out with the acronym there, right?
Oh my goodness. Spelled the old way, I assume, in jailer.
Okay. let me pull up a thought from our viewer Ash here. So Ash is reminding us that Basic also had living statues, which is basically stone golem light, and I agree with that, yeah.
Right, that's true. Yep. Which are interestingly called out in that little block of text we saw in OD&D. Living
right.
statues.
Right, exactly. Exactly, yep. Now, as long as we have this rules text on the page, let's talk about the basic ability, the fundamental abilities that golems normally have. So you can see that of the original three types, right, they have increasing requirements for magic weapons to hit them. So flesh, you need a plus one magic weapon. Stone, you need plus two. Iron, you need plus three. And in original D&D, the weapons only went up to plus three. That was the most magical weapon you could possibly get in the original books. They all have some kind of interest. You know, they have fixed hit points, right? Pretty much every other monster in the game has hit dice that you... theoretically roll. These have, for some reason it feels like a robot, like they're manufactured. There's a specific template that they're all stamped on, so they have fixed hit points.
Except dragons, right? I think we had that discussion before about dragon hit points. And
true. Gotta roll for their age. Once you get their age, you're totally right. Yep. And then they have some kind of special ability, usually, like the stone golem can cast a slow spell. The clay golem can haste itself. Once you get that on the table, the iron golem breathes instant death poison gas. Thank you very much. But the main thing about golems here in the classic game is that they are immune to magic. Just stone cold, no magic affects them whatsoever. Not an advantage to not a good saving throw, not an advantage, not magic resistance. It just says either spells have no effect, or no other magic, right? No magic can possibly affect these things, with maybe one, with one single exception each that doesn't even do any damage, but usually slows it. So depending on type, mm-hmm. you can hit it with a fire or a cold spell or lightning, and then it slows it for a couple rounds, and that's it. Other than that, absolutely no magic whatsoever, at least depending on how you read this.
And then clearly and then no weird spells that heal them.
Yes, exactly. Like, most notably with the Flesh Golem, if you hit it with lightning, like Dr. Frankenstein did in the first place, then you wind up healing your Flesh Golem.
Yep. Fascinating.
Oh, I like it. So Ash is in the chat saying he figured that the Iron Golem's poison gas death ability was carbon monoxide being exhausted from the machine.
taking it in a very steampunky direction, but sure, yeah.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. And of course, I guess we're not seeing it on this page, but as soon as you get into the next edition, right, they give very specific requirements for building golems, and it takes a top-level caster, like an 18th-level wizard or a 16th-level cleric or something like that, with top-level spells and immensely expensive components to actually build one.
Yeah, I remember seeing that text as a kid and always being, like, really confused by it. Not because, like, it's not unclear how it works, but just not imagining any player ever wanting to go through that. Like, and frankly, never saw it in a game. Did you ever see it in a game?
I did not.
Yeah. It seemed like the hoops were so numerous that no one was ever going to do this. So why bother to specify it?
I'm very sympathetic. And I'm very sympathetic that I think that was my, I think I kind of wanted to see that. It was like, someday I'm going to see that. And I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems, and on the other hand, odd. When you interpret golems, yeah, I agree. And on the other hand, it's like when that's like a factor in interpreting golems for me is like, if you did go through that, I wouldn't want it to just get beat down the first fight that you're in either. So I would want them to be like robust enough that it was worthwhile that enormous expense.
It seems really odd, right? Like, cause I could go through all this expense to construct this golem, or I could just cast Conjure Elemental, right? Why am I gonna bother with all this stuff? Is it really that much better than an Earth Elemental? Yeah.
Now, admittedly, elementals aren't entirely immune to magic, but it's a really good point. And in fact, in the original Clay Golem write up, there's a very clear connection to Earth Elementals. Actually, at least twice it says it works like an Earth Elemental this way, and it works like an Earth Elemental this way. And it's funny because, like I have this one miniature on my shelf, and I get confused about whether that's a stone elemental or a clay golem, or a stone golem, right? And I'm like, I guess it's so clearly related. I sometimes can't tell the difference myself just visually.
Sure. So how have you seen golems used, Dan? And now I'm trying to remember. Like what classic modules do we even see these things show up in?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Paul. So, and that is the primary way that they show up in my game is if they were included in some classic module. And I can think of, and it's, you know, fairly common for the higher level modules. White Plume Mountain actually has a couple in it, in a notable puzzle. There's a very famous example that Rob Kuntz created when he was running games for Gary Gygax. One thing that comes to mind, Paul, is that in AD&D Module A3, the assault on the area of the slave lords, the third section starts. Actually, the very first encounter in the third section starts with a golem, and that was, for what it's worth, it was the semi-championship tournament round at Gen Con 1980. I have an image of this, actually. So there's an image of somebody being, like, punched. It's got, like, an orange module cover.
Yep.
Yeah. So Assault on the Area of the Slave Lords, and there's a nice piece of art by Jeff D. The very first encounter in the last part of that module actually is And they try to get tricky, right? So what they did is they took a flesh golem, which normally has pretty cruddy AC, and bolted a whole bunch of armor plates on it in order to improve its armor. And okay. This comes to mind, Paul, because you fought this on Sunday.
Yep.
So I think that one of these characters getting choked to death was you on last Sunday.
I think my character is possibly the one standing all the way in the back, not getting choked. Generally, I ended up playing Fanster in the Illusionist, who really, frankly, doesn't shine, I think, until A4.
In my
experience, an illusionist illusion spells aren't really helpful in most of the A series modules, and I kind of wonder why Fanstern was included at all, frankly, in some of these. It takes a lot of creativity to leverage that character in any way whatsoever. The funny thing is, why do I say he shines in A4? Because spoiler alert for A4. The characters get taken prisoner and stripped of all their equipment and shoved into a dungeon, a literal dungeon, right? A literal, like, you're in prison now. And Fanstern's got one of the highest dexterities. And so ends up being the character with the best AC for that module.
Oh.
At least initially.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah, isn't that strange? That's pretty funny.
That's what I've seen
every time I've both played and run A4,
okay.
And every time I've seen that game played or run, the wizards weirdly get shoved to the front of the party in the beginning, at least. They're the best ACs.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I'm prepping to run A4 at some point in the future. I haven't run it yet, so that's actually good for me to hear, because I think I would have been surprised by that. Fascinating.
Yep. I've seen it happen. People are like, oh, you got the best AC, off you go.
That's
anyway,
a pretty deep cut.
So
we're debating ability scores from particular characters in a 1980 module. That's a very deep cut, and I like it.
So my experience fighting this creature isn't great. Again, just because I was looking at my character sheet and like, well, I have no magic that can affect this thing whatsoever. Regardless of the fact that magic doesn't affect golems. Even so, I was like, I have no magic that can help us in any way either. I have nothing, and nor do I have a weapon. So I'm going to hide in the back and let you fighters take care of it. Good luck. Basically the result. And that's kind of what happens with golems, right? They just turn into slugfests with your fighter types.
Correct.
Yeah.
To the best of my interpretive ability, the whole point is to just wipe the magic off the magic spells just off the table for that fight.
Here's my question for you, Dan. Is that good? Is that fun? Is that an interesting challenge? Or is that just weird?
Well, you were the player on Sunday, and I guess you knew. But some of the other players didn't. So there were at least two wizards who did throw spells at that particular disguised flesh golem and, had a big stop hand in front of their face. How did that feel on your end about the spells just doing absolutely nothing and being wasted?
The funny thing is, I knew, because I remember that you've been talking about this. This has been a topic of discussion prior to you running the game. And then somebody at the table also knew, because somebody said, oh, that's right, golems are immune to magic, after casting a spell at it and seeing it fizzle off of it. And then I was kind of curious, you were in the other half of this module earlier in the convention. Was there also a golem in that one?
I don't think so. What I feel like there was some other time when the magic was just doing absolutely nothing. What was it in the first part? I can't remember what the first of it is. The caves. Yeah.
Yeah. What I found interesting was obviously, I think you made some comments about poison gas, right? As this thing was attacking us. And it's got these metal plates attached to it. I assume the point there was to fake us out into making us think that it was an iron golem when really it was just a flesh golem. And I was like, what I found really interesting about that is I thought, wow, this writing really is targeted at 1980 tournament scene of players who have like studied the monster manual prior to coming this. Because I thought there's no way anyone at this table realizes that that's a bluff. And like, because we're supposed to think that it's an iron golem when really it's a flesh golem. I'm like, I don't think anyone here is getting that nuance. I think
that's
lost.
That's a really interesting observation. How many things in classic D&D, like in, you know, as of the supplements a year after publication, were take some expectation from expert players and then twist it around, and throw it back in their face. And you know, that's really the origin of like mimics or ear seekers or rot grubs, which are all like, oh, you like listening at doors? Well, here's a thing in a door that specifically punishes you for that thing.
Right.
And you know, I'll say honestly, like I came, so you guys, you know, ran through this A3 module like true champions. You beat everything. And I don't know if you know, I don't know if I told you, Paul, but I was actually doubling and tripling and quadrupling the monsters all the way through it compared to what the module actually says.
I noticed that at the end, or I noticed at the point where there were multiple minotaurs, because I was trying to remember that. It's been a long time since I read the module, but I was like, I thought there was only one minotaur.
So instead of one minotaur, I made it four. Instead of two gelatinous cubes, I made it three. Instead of what else was the thing? And you know, in the AD&D book, hellhounds only do 5 points of damage, and I made it 5 dice of damage when they breathed on you.
Wow!
To make it a little bit more tense, and you still beat the whole thing. You beat the slavers at the end, largely with a lot of charm and hold spells and fancer and script tripping that. And I will say, I came away from that game. You know, I'm not going to change the charm person spell. It's, you know, classically it's powerful, but I did come away thinking maybe I'm going to start making magic items of like, you know, immunity to charms and holds, just to give additional spice at some point with him. So I can kind of see the motivation. Like if that's happening a lot in your game, maybe that's a response from the DM. But it's funny how many things, like the golem immunity, is clearly to put a brick wall in front of some existing strategy.
Well, and here's the odd thing about that, especially as it comes to golems, right? I'm like, okay, so it's interesting. There's a moment of shock amongst the players of like, oh no, not really none? Like, well, maybe we're going to waste a couple of rounds chucking spells at it and going, oh wow, it really is immune to everything, all magic, oh no. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what else is left? I guess just set the fighters at it. And then it turns into just this back and forth rolling. And I wonder, you know, haven't you just taken away part of the most interesting D&D of that creative out of the box thinking and said, no, you're not allowed to be creative and think outside the box. Now you just have to roll dice. Like, is that good?
It's interesting. I think I can live with it for like, you know, one encounter at a time. I wouldn't want to go through a whole dungeon like that, obviously. Now I have seen, there is this point, like I think when, if I recall correctly, like actually when you and I ran a game with the great folks from WebDM, Tomb of Rehotep had a stone golem in it, which I think I doubled. Or maybe I'm confusing this with another time I've run that. But then there's this moment of like, well, now what do the wizards do? So the wizard's normal spells thing is not available. What can they do? And I've seen them like, hand off all their magic weapons or get out rope and try to tangle up the feet of the golem or something like that. So at that moment, it becomes like, instead of relying on your normal spell list, you actually have to get more creative with the wizard players to do anything at all.
Interesting. Which of course then is exactly where the A series goes, right? By the fourth one, you're now at a point of like, now I've stripped you of everything. You have no spells, no magic items, no equipment of any kind. You must be creative because you're just a bunch of naked characters. Good luck. and that's, I think, fascinating. That is fascinating. That's really interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, at the time, you know, go ahead.
I would want to see golems used in a way where they're not just like there is a golem, and to get through the room, you must beat the golem. I would rather see them used in interesting, more interesting ways where like there are other threats and other things going on that you have to deal with. And also, by the way, this direction is there's a stinking golem. Oh, darn it. Right. I'm thinking of stuff like the way the shambling mound is used in that module where, you know, it's blocking the one walkable path, and then players are encouraged to like, well, how else can I get across this area? Right. Can I swim through the water? Can I make a boat? Can I fly? Right. I think that's more interesting to me than just the way the golem is presented, where it's just in a room and the joke, if you will, is, haha, I tricked you into thinking this was an iron golem when really it's a flesh golem.
Which nowadays nobody would recognize. It's really funny I think I'm glad that we have more casual players today. I'm glad that the audience has expanded and that I can expect to grab a larger population of people at my table and not have people that have just entirely memorized the rule books because they're like me. I don't want that.
Right. That's a good point. That's a really good point.
I don't want all D&D players to be just like me. That's too much, man.
That's too much, Dan.
You know, it's a strong spice, honestly. Let me throw out two really great comments from viewers here. How do I do this? I send this. Okay, so William said this, and I agree. He said, golems are clearly a FU in particular monster of just blocking wizards, and he's comparing that to rust monsters at a lower hit dice level, which are the FU monster for fighters, which actually also appears in Module A3. That's actually the monster at the last encounter of the first session. There's a disguised rust monster that's there to just eat, gobble up all the equipment of all the fighters in a disguised state. So it's interesting to point that out because that adventure actually did add both of those things.
Yeah. Well, I feel like you're getting a peek behind the curtain of what it was like to be writing the tournament module in 1980, right? By this point, D&D has been out for a couple of years. This tournament is supposed to be the big tournament. And so they're expecting, like, these are the expert players. These are the players who have studied all the rule books. So we need the FU monsters and we need to disguise them just to really, really throw players and make them, you know, you trick them.
Yeah. There's a couple of funny things like that last encounter in the first part of Module A3 is kind of interesting because there is a villain illusionist. So here I'm spoiling a bunch of stuff. So two things they do there. Yeah. Number one, the back of the module, right, the actual back cover of the module, the artwork, which might be by Errol Otis or something like that, features a giant ankylosaurus like coming at the players. And so you pick that up in the store and you go, wow, this module has dinosaurs. It's got an ankylosaur in a dungeon. That's great. I'm going to buy it. And you open it up and the FU is, no, there is no ankylosaur. It's an illusion. It doesn't actually exist. It's instead, yeah. If there isn't that, instead it's a rust monster coming at you. Ha ha. We actually tricked you in purchasing the product. The illusionist presents himself as Yinogu, the demon god of gnolls and ghouls. And just like you were saying, Paul, like, I don't think anybody's, like, if I say, I'm going to breathe poison gas on you, therefore, you know, I'm an iron golem, et cetera. You know, when I think I read the text describing a giant gnoll that's got a three-headed flail and has red burning eyes, I read that and was like, no one's going to know what that is. I have to say out loud, and this is the demon lord of gnolls.
Because those details,
the players at the table aren't that, you know, religiously affiliated with it anymore.
Yep. That's fascinating.
So here's a comment from Disparil, which is a really great point that I personally overlooked. So we were talking about what can the wizards do, and Disparil BB is saying, well, the golem might be immune to magic, but you could still buff the fighters. You cast protective spells and strength spells and stuff like that on the fighters to help them out, which is a different perspective.
Yeah.
Great point.
Yeah, except for when you're Fanster and the Illusionist and you don't have any such spells. But
now you're making me feel bad about how you playing Fanster.
No, don't feel bad about it. The interesting thing is I had last pick, and so it's not surprising that I ended up with Van Stern. This is really me picking on the authors of the module to say, why did you put such a totally useless character as one of the pre-gens? Okay. I don't know why Van Stern's in there. I think they were just illusionists are new and exciting, because that's a thing in AD&D.
Illusionists.
That's a good point.
That is a good point.
Yep. And then let's fill the module with monsters that are never, they're definitely not ever going to be fooled by any kind of illusion.
Well, so next time, Paul, I will make sure you get a fighter. We'll change that up when we learn A4. I'll make sure that you get a fighter next time so you don't have to run
fast. Thanks, Dan. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Glad to be of service.
Oh, dear.
So there's a famous
A4 is so one of my favorite modules. So I probably I might have to sit that one out, Dan, just because I know A4 much better than I know A3.
So there's a famous really famous example of a particular golem. The first time it showed up in the game, I think it was created by Rob Kuntz, and it appears in what ultimately got published like 10 years after the fact as Mordenkainen's Fantastic Adventure. And interestingly, Kuntz was DMing, Gygax was a player and was playing Mordenkainen and Bigby, to my understanding at the time, at a very high level, wandered in this location, and I guess there's the first Iron Golem. And it's super hyped up. I have an image of this, actually. So there's the, when this got published, there's a thing sitting on a throne at the top of some stairs there. So this is the picture of in the throne there, the very first Iron Golem that Kuntz made, and it's also hyper accelerated because in addition to its normal powers, in its right hand it's holding a whip made of cockatrice feathers and turns you to stone on contact. And in the left there's a sword of poisoning that poisons you to death immediately as soon as it hits you. And just in case you thought it was going to throw poison gas at you, it throws fire at you instead. Can't be affected by any magic. Mm-hmm. Can't be affected by any magic weapons either. No magic weapons that you carry into the fight can be used against it whatsoever. Now I'm going to spoil this. I'll just say the only things that can be used against it are things in this picture.
Interesting.
Absolutely nothing else that your characters bring into the fight have any effect on it whatsoever. These all appear as everything you see in the picture is statues when you walk into the room.
Gotcha.
I'll just leave it at that. And Mordenkainen got turned to stone, and they had to retreat, and they had to bring in extra backup of high level characters in the Greyhawk campaign. And Gygax was sufficiently impressed by this that he wrote up the story of this hideous fight in a journal called War Games Digest in May 1974, a little bit before D&D was published.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I think that for some of this like colors my sense of what golems are supposed to be in D&D is this like really massive total screw job, very explicitly. And, you know, that's what the game was like. And Gygax was sufficiently impressed that was his initial like promotion of what D&D was going to be like. You were going to have adventures like this, whereby you just totally get screwed by the DM and lose all your characters. Huh. And you should buy this.
Lord.
You should buy this box set for the low price of $10.
This is what D&D is going to be like. A thing that throws away all the rules of D&D. What?
Yep.
That's weird. That is very strange. Sure.
So let me talk a little bit about interpreting and a couple things about this, right? This is the extra paragraph in the first volume of D&D that said living statues. Like it says, there was one very special living statue that held a whip of cockatrice feathers and a poison sword and could only be affected by these other things. And so this was actually, you know, you didn't get statistics, but this was, you did get this allusion to this particular encounter in the very first monster book in the 1974 box set. And then interestingly, that story that Gygax wrote up, you can still find a little snippet of it in the fifth edition monster manual.
Really?
Yeah. Look at the picture. I have a little picture of a scroll. It's like a brown scroll there.
You'll have to give me a moment here. Yep. This?
Yeah. So that's a snippet out of the fifth edition monster manual on the page for golems. Maybe you can read that for us just in case someone's listening to us on the podcast.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sorry. It says, beyond the unopenable doors lay a grand hall ending before a towering stone throne, upon which sat an iron statue taller and wider than two men. In one hand it clutched an iron sword, in the other a feather whip. We should have turned back then. Morning King and the Archmage chronicles of his party's harrowing exploits in the dungeon below Moor Castle. Moor?
Yeah, Moor, something like that.
Moore? Okay,
yeah.
Great.
As usual, I've seen this for 40 years, and I realize right now I don't know how to pronounce it.
Excellent.
So more or less, that's not a direct quote, but that's basically a synopsis of Gygax writing up his adventure as Mordenkainen. And it's kind of, I think it's kind of cool that it actually appears in the fifth edition Monster Manual right there.
Yeah, that is nice. That is nice. Nice little callback there.
So pretty, pretty influential. That particular golem venture. So let me talk about the problem of interpreting the exact meaning of what the rules say in original D&D. And of course, they're very curt, they're very sketchy. They don't have keywords or anything like that. So for flesh and stone golems, it says they're not affected by spells. And then for the iron golem, it says it's not affected by any magic, with this one exception. And that gets copy-pasted without any change whatsoever into first edition AD&D. So I was like, at some point it became a question to me about like, what about magic items? Right? It says flesh and stone, you're not affected by spells. What about magic items? What about a wand or fireballs? What about other monsters?
Right.
So a couple months back, I went and asked polls on a couple of sites. And what I commonly do is, for the OD&D perspective, I go to the ODD74 forums, which is really great. And for the first edition perspective, I go to there's a big Facebook first edition group. And so I ask kind of the same question on both. And it's the same language. It's like literally the same words in this case. Usually both parties tend to agree. So I think there's a first poll image. So I asked like, what are goals supposed to be immune to based on that language? And interestingly, the OD&D players, not that it's a very big sample size, but the OD&D players overwhelmingly said, well, the meaning is meant to be the same for all the golems. They're meant to be immune to all magic, period. Magic items and spells and supernatural effects and everything. All the golems altogether are supposed to be just immune to that. Whereas the first edition players, more of them, that actually go back. That's a different question. Yeah. So on this one page right here on the top, I've got the
we're looking at the results of two different answers. Results. Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Gotcha.
Right. And then further down, okay. I've got the AD&D poll. And the AD&D poll at the bottom of this slide right here has a different response. The vast majority of people there said that the effect varies by golem, that flesh and stone are supposed to be immune to only spells and nothing else. Whereas the iron golem is supposed to be immune to everything. So I'm not used to a difference in response. So I thought I was very surprised by this different response to what's actually the exact same series of words.
Interesting. Yeah. But the text that they're going from here is different, right? Right. The top poll we're looking at OD&D text.
I snipped out the exact recreation of the text, but it's basically the same series of words in both rule books. Both original and first edition use the same words. So maybe there's a lot of first edition DMs that allow you to hit a golem with a, I don't know, wand of fireballs or rod of lordly might, or I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting. What were you expecting? And which result do you agree with?
Okay, I agree with the OD&D vote. There is, it seemed simpler to say that it seems to be really the same intent all across the board. Yeah. So if one of them is immune to all magic, they all should be, and that gets somewhat more clearly expressed in later editions. So later editions clearly say they're immune to all magic, and I thought that was the original intent.
Interesting.
Okay. What about you? Would you like it? Would you like them to just be immune to spells, but then magic items are a different thing? Or,
oh, I don't know. I mean, your example of wand of fireballs is especially troubling, right? Because it's a magic item that emulates a spell. So surely that falls under spells, right? Mm-hmm. Surely, but where's the line? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think ultimately because of the introduction of gray area, I don't want to add even more gray area by saying it varies by golem. So I think I would lean into let's just say magic in general.
Yeah,
it's just an easier answer. It's an easier answer to DM, I think.
I agree with that. So that's how I run it at my table, and that's the assumption that I use when I'm assessing like the danger of these monsters, is that they're just totally immune to magic like that. Yeah.
Right.
So and then I had this other question. So I had it in my simulator, right? My arena simulator that simulates D&D combat and then spits out numbers for how dangerous these things are, and I was working on that like last December and January in my break. And then I had that in the system, and then I was like, here's a question. And on the next slide, you're going to see me being the wrongest that I've ever been in my entire life about interpreting D&D. Is my question was, can a wizard conjure an elemental and then have the elemental hit successfully a golem? And I was very, very confident. I was extremely confident. The answer is clearly no. Obviously, the answer is no. Golems are immune to all magic. And the whole point is an F you to wizards. Thank you, William. Is just shut down wizards. Yep. They can't do anything. All their magic is totally useless. You cannot damage a golem. End of story. Clearly, to me, the answer was going to be no. And unanimously, everybody else that I've ever asked this to is very confident the answer is the opposite is yes. I found almost nobody at all that's willing to agree with me on that. And you can see that on the OD&D forum, 100% of all the people said, yes, absolutely, conjure an elemental and fight the golem with that instead. And on the Facebook first edition board, 149 out of 154 votes, that's a 97% response rate, all said yes, including our good friends Angela Blank and Frank Mentzer. We're in that vote saying yes there. Only one single person said no, and that's Mr. Cecil Vick of Madison, Mississippi. Thank you, Cecil, for agreeing with me. So I have never been so surprised by anything interpretively in D&D in all my years. I was completely confident the answer was clearly going to be no, just F you to wizards all the way down the board, and everybody all thinks that I am wrong about that. So apparently I must be wrong about that.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to what our comment before, like what do wizards do? And one of the things they can do is cast buff spells, right? So is a golem going to take extra damage from a fighter who's had a strength spell cast on them? Or are they immune to that?
You know, they're getting hit, you know, the spell, to me, the spell effects on the fighter, right? The fighter's been changed.
Well,
right.
Sure, but in this case, not a spell is it a spell effect on the elemental or on the area? Like, it's the spell effect was to conjure the elemental. Now there's an elemental here. It would seem weird, especially if a golem just happened upon an elemental, and that elemental could beat him up, no problem. Whereas a conjured elemental, not working. I don't know why. Can't seem to connect.
I would have been okay with that. I absolutely would have been okay with that, and have a distinction about like had to have a distinction about a native present elemental versus one that was created out of magic.
Let's say I had a portable hole, and I went to the elemental plane of Earth, and I captured a stone elemental inside my portable hole, and then I encountered a golem, and I released the elemental from the hole. Can that elemental damage the golem?
Yes. Dan of a year ago says yes.
Okay. But it's somehow no the spell counter on the spell. Golem. Yeah, okay. It's weird. It's weird, Dan.
Now let me defend myself.
I gotta disagree with you on this one. Yeah.
Join the very long list, with Paul.
164 other people and say you're wrong.
So you know what? This is why I asked the polls, right? This is why you run the science. Someday you're going to be surprised, and I am with this, and I will absolutely redirect my game to match other people's expectations if I'm this far out of the ballpark. Now, in my defense for my prior thinking, I think possibly I was slightly biased by Gygax's story of playing with Kuntz. Is with that original Iron Golem that Gygax fought, they summoned an Ifrit. And out of an Ifrit sent it against the golem, and it did nothing.
Yeah, and it did nothing.
Mordenkainen tried to hit it with a magical staff, and it did nothing. They cast Transmute Rock to Mud under the feet of the Iron Golem to make it sink down, and it wouldn't even do that. It refused to sink into magical mud. So at least reading that story, my thinking was that the intent was, like, not even sinking into magical mud, was a total FU, just no spell is going to do anything to it whatsoever. Obviously, the counter argument is to say, well, that's a special golem made up by Kuntz that doesn't match normal golems, and he was just like extra putting the screws to Gygax. But that was my reading, and I think probably I bring that to my reading of the golem stats of like, an Ifrit's not going to work, an elemental's not going to work.
All right, let's spoil it, Dan. What is the answer to that golem here? I'm going to go back to the picture. You said the only things that can affect it are in this picture. So my gut is telling you have to steal its weapons. You have to steal its weapons and use its own weapons against it.
You're very close. It's not its weapons.
Yeah. Oh, it's the weapons of the other two statues, which I'm not seeing that they're even holding any. But
It's hard to see. But if you look closely.
Yeah. I guess the guy on the left's got a sword. And the guy on the right's got like a dagger.
Exactly.
Yeah. And those two items will affect the golem. That's it.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Nothing else.
See, I feel like the what's going on here is just that somebody felt like they made a very clever puzzle and didn't like somebody else trying to work around that puzzle in a creative, out of the box way. And they're like, no, you have to come up with the actual solution to the puzzle that I thought of beforehand. Stop trying to circumvent my puzzle. Because, I mean, it's not like the rock to mud thing really bothers me. What, like, maybe I could see, there's like an anti-magic shield or something, which would mean that the spell just doesn't go off at all. But if you're telling me, like, the ground underneath it turns to mud and it just walks across the mud, that feels really lame to me. I don't like it.
It's a strong argument, honestly. Yeah. It's a pretty good interpretation, and it's funny because a lot of the early modules like do get written with this, like there's one way to solve a particular puzzle, and sometimes I wonder about like how flexible they were with this. At least in this particular story, Kuntz seemed very inflexible. I feel like I myself have had to grow my DMing skills to become more flexible and be on the lookout for additional solutions.
Isn't that the joy of it, that you can do anything and thus like you can find these out of the box solutions that are not what the author was thinking of in the moment? I don't know.
I agree. I think I've had to grow in that direction, and I've made mistakes about that in the past, and I 100% agree with what you just said there, Paul. That should be the fun. And I enjoy discovering those solutions that I didn't know about in advance.
So given that possibly we have different opinions from the authors when the text was written. What does that mean for how you want to interpret golems? You know, do you like, how would you today interpret someone casting rock to mud under a golem? Do you want to allow them to sink? Do you want to change how in what ways they're immune, or what things they're immune to? Or
that's a really great question. I think for simplicity, I want to keep it they're immune to magic that gets thrown directly at them. I think I will take a lesson from the greater player community that you can conjure an elemental, have that attack it. I would let it sink into a rock to mud spell, and then maybe it, like, you know, climbs out the other side, because it's not like it has to breathe.
Right.
A couple rounds later, but I would do that now.
Right, right. That's the way to do it. Right. Is like, you know, if this monster is so incredibly powerful that it can overcome all these things, let it overcome them. Like, let it just, no, it just powers through. Comes out dripping mud. Great. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that actually does seem more
fun. I agree. Yeah.
I agree. You're right. Yeah. You're right, Paul. All right. Okay, I'm convinced.
All right. Great. Well, I'm glad we solved this. Great. Perfect.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much.
Took us an hour. We got to a solution. Dan, we are closing in on the end of the show here. Do you have any final thoughts about golems?
Well, two things. Now, I will say that, you know, this immunity to magic was maintained at least through third edition. Fifth edition did dial it down, right? Fifth edition, they're not immune anymore. They have advantage on saving throws. Advantage on saving throws of magic. They are not immune anymore. Not sure I totally agree with that about fifth edition. That seems like a distinct, regression. If I was a wizard making one of these things, I wouldn't be super happy about that.
Yeah, it does. It does seem like a real. It seems disappointing that now you've just opened the door for just some poor dice rolls, and now suddenly you have a world where golems can be polymorphed into chickens. Like, that's
right.
That's disappointing. Yeah.
So there's that. I can kind of see. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's funny how long the immunity lasted up until fifth edition before the change, actually. And the other thing I'll point out is that, again, like I said, when I run these through my arena simulator. The Iron Golem is the single most deadly monster in original D&D. The fact that you need +3 item to hit it, right? Dragons don't need that. Yeah. The fact they're entirely immune to magic, you know, dragons don't have that. So the Iron Golem comes out at, I call it equivalent hit dice. Some people would call it challenge rating of 140. And jeez. The next runner up, the second most dangerous monster comes in at 60, which is the Beholder. And then number three is the Stone Golem at 55. And then number four and number five are the Rakshasa and the Titan. Let me just point out why I say this. All five of those types all have some kind of anti-magic ability. The Golems, the Beholder has the anti-magic eyeball. Mm-hmm. The Rakshasa is totally immune to all spells under 8th level. And the Titan has magic resistance. So it's interesting that by putting the FU up to the wizards, that's fundamental to making the most dangerous monsters in original D&D. Maybe we should talk more about that at some future point, about how important, like, magic resistance abilities are, because that's the top five dangerous monsters that I can tell in D&D have that.
That is very interesting. And just generally the power curve of magic and wizards in particular is really interesting, right? Because they follow that very interesting curve of being really squishy and useless at the low levels, and then clearly game-changingly powerful at the end.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, that's how you guys finished Module A3, right? You went in and you basically beat the slavers at the end with, you know, mind control spells was basically the culminating climax of that.
True.
Good point.
Quite true.
Good point.
Quite true.
Yeah.
Viewers, if you have opinions, this seems like a potentially contentious point about golems and magic immunity. I'd love to hear it. Do you want to go against the 164 people who say that golems should be attackable by conjured elementals, or do you want to side with Dan and Cecil? Pick a team. Post us a comment here on the YouTube. We'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you think in terms of how immune to magic should golems truly be.
Yeah, yeah. I would. Maybe there's an unknown community. Maybe there's like a community living in the sewers that agree with me about not attacking your golems with elementals. But until we find that community, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We're on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and GitHub and also TikTok, and we have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. For look for us there, and you'll get updates on future shows.
If you prefer to listen to us in podcast-only format, you can find those shows at our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcasts on various podcast carriers, such as iTunes and Google Podcasts and Pocket Cast and Stitcher and all kinds of places. If you are using one of those third-party carriers and they do have the availability to rate and review the show, please do so. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DM show. If you would like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll see a couple different tiers, discounts on merch, access to a private Discord server, other stuff that we do. And we also have after party chat right after our Sunday show. So in about 10 minutes, I will be there today to join the after party chat. I think, Paul, today you have to take off. Is that right?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm wandering into the opposite coast from usual, so I will not be available for the after party chat, I'm afraid. So hopefully our kind patrons will stand up for the 164 and convince Dan that that he's wrong about
that. I'm going to make my case. I'm going to get in there today, and I'm going to make my case, and I think I can debate everybody over to my side. I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty persuasive. Right? But, you know, so a couple of things coming up this week, right? We have our normal Tuesday and Thursday shows. You know, there was a comment back there about actually illusionists being the cyberpunk hackers of D&D. And coincidentally, we have a cyberpunk game on the channel. It's happening Thursday nights that I'm actually taking part in, which is really a blast. So maybe you can check out our cyberpunk game on Thursday night.
And playing the hacker, if I recall correctly.
Totally. The hacker / math rock bassist.
Excellent.
And also the only human. I'm playing the only human on the show at the moment. So we're getting a lot of traction out of that. But the other thing, I am very excited about our guest next week, Paul. Next week, Sunday, we're going to have Karen Twelves, who is the author of the book Improv for Gamers, and she's coming out with second edition. You know, the very second episode that we ever did on this show in the first season was on using improv in your game. So I'm personally really excited to talk to Karen next week and get some questions about her expertise on improv.
Excellent. I'm really excited about that, too. I'm a big fan of her book. Looking forward to hearing about what might be different in the second edition.
Cool. Awesome. So, yeah. So we'll hope that you join us next week for the interview with Karen Twelves on Improv for Gamers. Of course, we are live every Sunday. That'll be at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.